Justice by any means necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
So my name is Noor. I am a member of the Palestinian Feminist Collective. Feminism. And we are a national organization, but we have members in a bunch of cities all across the United States and in Canada. And we do lots of organizing. You may have seen us as a part of the DNC coalition. We were also part of international working women's day movements that happened all across the country. We're on social media, we're online, we're everywhere. If you look up Palestinian Feminist Collective, you will find us. And then I am joined today by Dr. Iman Abdelhadi. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, y'all. It's kind of my fault that we're starting on Arab Standard Time. My name is Iman. I am a professor at UChicago. I'm a sociologist. I also organize with a local group called Salon Kawakib and organize with the faculty and staff for Justice in Palestine at the University of Chicago and a couple other formations. I also write for In These Times and other stuff. I don't know. Oh, I co-authored a novel called Everything for Everyone.
It's so good. So
where we liberate Palestine in chapter 2. So highly recommend it personally. But and Noor, this is really Noor's show. I'm here to help facilitate a discussion at the end of the presentation. Inshallah.
Inshallah. Okay, so we don't have a projector in this room, but there's QR codes everywhere. So if you scan the QR code, you should be able to find the presentation. They're a little blurry, so you might have to try a couple times, but should be fine. So I just want to start off by asking a question. Just a show of hands, how many of you have heard of the Nakba of 1948? Okay, everyone, hands down. And then how many of you have heard of the 1917 Balfour Declaration? Okay, nice. Shout out to SJP and their Palestine 101s. So most of us are familiar with these events. Okay. But if you're not, just a quick refresher, the Nakba, or the catastrophe in Arabic, refers to the expulsion of over 750,000 Palestinians from their ancestral homeland in 1948. Took place over the course of 1947 to 1949. Tens of thousands of Palestinians were killed, displaced, and imprisoned over this period to create what is now known as the modern-day state of Israel. And so every May, it's commemorated, and this year marks the 76th anniversary of the Nakba. And the Balfour Declaration of 1917 obviously precedes the Nakba, and it's this colonial kind of agreement that is penned in secret. It comes after Sykes-Picot, in which the British, the Italians, the Russians, and the French decide how they want to divvy up kind of their colonial spoils. And so Arthur Balfour, who is part of like the British diplomacy, works on this in secret with the Ottoman Empire, Chaim Weizmann, who ends up being the first president of Israel. I mean, it's a real collaboration that ultimately says that the British want to promise a Jewish homeland on top of Palestinian land. And it is intended to stay this secret until the Bolshevik Revolution happens in Russia in 1917. And then Lenin discovers this document and, along with Sykes-Picot, kind of reveals this to the general public and calls this an agreement between colonial thieves. And so it's kind of a shock to the world, but it's also really not a shock to the world. It's kind of exactly what you'd expect. But we want to focus on this period of history, 1917 to 1948, pre-Nakba, and honestly a little bit before. We're going to get into that era of history as well, because it's an incredibly important but largely ignored portion of Palestinian history, and there are definitely a few reasons why. So why is it important for us to study this history? Why pre-Nakba and why labor? So one, it tells us that Palestinian history does not begin or end with the Nakba. It is over a 100-year struggle for the self-determination of the Palestinian people against Zionist forces, but also British imperial forces, who somehow get off the hook for this more than they should. And then two, it demonstrates to us that the Zionist entity was not inevitable. There was a time before Zionism, and it is possible to have a time after Zionism. Thank you. And it was a time when the Palestinian resistance came close to bringing the British Empire to its knees. We'll talk about this more later, but this revolt that we're focusing on, the revolt that's kind of the star of the show, was the largest anti-colonial struggle in the interwar period, and it's not really talked about that much. Three, talking about this period of time helps us clarify the contradictions that kind of emerge in a settler colonial context, especially as they relate to the conditions of the working class, the fallahin, the Palestinian peasants. And four, learning about the people power that kind of nearly bought imperial and colonial forces down during the revolution, it helps us reflect on who are our allies, who are our enemies, and what can we learn from this moment of history and apply it to our reality now. We'll see a lot of parallels. I'm sure you will hear a lot of parallels yourself, and you might already know a lot of this history. So we're just gonna start with the course roadmap. I think that's like slide three or something. That's where we are, just to orient you around these slides on your phone. So first, I'm going to give some context on the state of Palestinians during the time of the Mandate. Then we're going to flash back to the first and second waves of Jewish settlement in Palestine to establish kind of the where and why of both Palestinians and Zionists prior to this period of time that we're focusing on. And then we'll sort of move forward in history from there as we get into the revolution. So going to this slide about conditions from Ottoman to the Mandate, the transition between the Ottoman Empire and the British Empire was a lot like the establishment of most European colonies. It takes on a really bureaucratic character. And this, of course, includes formalizing private property relations. So this is done through land registration and deed ownership. And if we go to this next slide about the fallahin, at this time, the Palestinian working class is pre-industrial, is comprised almost entirely of poor fallahin, working class peasants. And so if you're registering a deed and securing land, that requires a lot of money that none of them have. And so most Palestinians forego registering their land entirely, and the Palestinians who do register their land often document it as smaller than its actual size so that they don't have to pay as large of a fee to do so. And that can result in a lot of problems that I'm sure you can imagine. So while the majority of economic activity, again, in this era is primarily agricultural, there are also several major cities that serve as like activities of metropolitan hubs and where the working class will ultimately industrialize and a lot of the Palestinian labor movement will take place. And so Haifa and Yaffa are ports that kind of serve as outlets for like good embarkation. And I would pay attention to those cities specifically because they'll come up quite a lot as we talk about the revolution, but also, for example, Gaza and El Khalil in the south are major metropolitan areas and market centers. And so though Palestinians are not generally unionized at this time, again, because of non-industrial conditions that they find themselves in, their labor and their positionality as stewards of the land, nevertheless, is a topic of conversation amongst colonial powers. So in 1907, at the Stuttgart Conference, AKA the Second International, there's this convening of European labor parties where they're talking about workers in European colonies, specifically native workers. And as they talk about kind of all native workers, they're talking about Palestinians as these unsophisticated, uncivilized people who are incapable of stewarding their own land. They're not capable enough of doing what they've been doing for hundreds of thousands of years. And so this is used as kind of the narrative justification for the British mandate in Palestine, and this is kind of where it emerges, but it's not really new, tale as old as time, unfortunately. And so now that we have kind of this point of history to anchor ourselves vaguely around the mandate period, we're actually going to go back a few decades and talk about the initial waves of settlement in Palestine so we can talk about kind of what led up to the formation of specifically labor Zionism as the colonial ideology responsible for the Nakba. And so that slide, Zionism versus labor, is kind of where we're at now. So in tandem with some of the more like prominent theorizations of Zionism that we see from figures like Theodor Herzl, the first and second waves of Jewish settlement in Palestine unfold. And early on, there is honestly a lot of discourse around the utility of Zionism as this like meaningful quote unquote liberation theology. So if you look at that slide with Karl Kautsky on it, he is a Jewish anti-Zionist labor So, for example, in the early 1900s, the anti-Zionist Jewish Bund, which was a labor party of Jewish workers that emerged under the Russian Empire, condemned Zionism for both its anti-Semitic solution to anti-Semitism, which is necessarily the expulsion of Jewish people from Europe, and it also condemned Zionism for its colonization of Palestinians and actively works to drive Zionists out of their unions. And so in 1910, Kautsky writes, "It is labor that gives people a right to the land in which it lives." And you can read the rest of the quote on your own time. But this dominant stance, this idea that labor and Zionism are incompatible because the labor movement is a struggle for freedom and Zionism is a settler colonial ideology, this principled stance slowly begins to fall apart. And labor politics quickly gets co-opted by Zionists in service of settler colonialism. And this is evident in the way that Zionists speak about Palestinians and in the material ways that Zionists plan in accordance with settler colonial goals in mind. And so some of the earliest iterations of Zionism justifying the colonization of Palestine occupy this like pseudo left wing and even pseudo feminist character. And I say that with like very heavy air quotes. So now we're on this slide about the first and second waves of colonization. So during the first and second waves of colonization, we're going to focus a little bit on kibbutzim, which are these like quote unquote agricultural collectives that emerge. And they build exclusively Jewish settlements on Palestinian land and militantly guard them with militias that come to form the Haganah, one of the violent settler militias responsible for the Nakba, and that plays a key role in the revolts. And there are a lot of violent militias that actually come out of the Nakba. A not so fun fact is that former mayor Rahm Emanuel's father was actually part of one of these militias. His father was one of the original members of the Irgun and was an active participant and player in the Nakba. So our history is very intertwined in this city and with Palestine. So the next slide talks a little bit about these kibbutzim. So the purpose of the kibbutzim was actually not allowed to be set by its members. It was set by the Jewish National Fund, whose capital advancements in the form of land and other means of production comes with very specific economic and political stipulations. And one of these economic stipulations is the necessary boycott of Palestinian workers. And so the Jewish National Fund, JNF, even went so far as to impose a penalty on Jewish owners who would hire Palestinian laborers. And this all happens with the tacit approval, of course, of the British Mandate in the United States. So kibbutzim's values were not their like quote-unquote socialist traits, but the geopolitical and military services, which they provided the Zionist colonial project by driving Palestinians off their land and harvesting their crops through this like form of primitive accumulation. And so during the first wave of colonization that takes place from the early 1880s into the 1900s, primarily Russian Jewish farmers begin establishing the early yeshiv in Palestine. And this is sort of the governing body that operates under, but also in tandem with the British Mandate government, and it explicitly represents the interest of settlers. And the yeshiv is going to come up a lot, the yeshiv, the Haganah, and the Histadrut, which we'll get to later. The American labor movement, amongst many other non-state actors at this time, also supported creating a Jewish-only settler colony on Palestinian land. So the labor movement in the United States consisted of labor federations, unions, and fraternal orders that aided the Zionist cause with financial and political resources. So this included purchasing land for kibbutzim and also economic aid to the Histadrut, which is the Jewish-only labor federation that would eventually take footing in Palestine. And we will talk about that in depth when we get to the next portion. So the movement stood in direct opposition to the anti-Zionist Jewish Bund that had been forming. But eventually, this anti-Zionist Jewish Bund would sort of give way and dissolve into both the Yeshiv and kind of embrace Israel as a possible emancipatory project. I also think it's important, as a member of the Palestinian Feminist Collective, to talk about how women settlers played a key role in this time in bolstering some of the first iterations of feminist labor Zionism. So while they primarily work as domestic laborers within their home, they also serve as some of the earliest propagandists for the Zionist colonial project. And so they facilitate the transition from Yiddish as the lingua franca for Jewish Palestinians living in Palestine to Hebrew for Jewish settlers. And this is part of kind of like the myth making and the establishment of these like biblical origins that necessitate the creation of a settler colony on Palestinian land. And they do this through their work in Hebrew school. And during the second wave of colonization from the early 1900s until the late 1910s, Zionist settler women begin feminist worker movements, and they fight for participation within the colonial project and inclusion within the settler governing structure of the Yishuv. So their efforts actively contribute to the colonization of Palestine, and their advocacy was for inclusion within this new Yishuv that kind of like honors settler women, as opposed to, say, gender and class solidarity with Palestinian Falahi women. And so this is why settler colonialism, and thereby national liberation, emerges these kind of like primary structures to be addressed, as opposed to first and foremost something like workers' consciousness. And so now we can kind of move to this slide on colonialism and settler colonialism as the primary contradiction. Now that we have like a little bit of schema on what's going on, we can get back to this focal point in our timeline around 1917. So during the late 1910s into the mid-1920s, it's important to understand like how this contradiction that we're talking about actually unfolds. So first we have the JNF, which is actively colonizing Palestine. Then we have the British mandate, which establishes British control of the means of production. And then we have Western firms, which have an interest in industrializing parts of Palestine and shaping the labor force for colonial extraction. And so the character of the Palestinian working class shifts under these changes. It moves from largely Falahi peasants, which it had been for almost the entirety of its history, to more industrial workers. And if we go to that next slide about the early mandate in the Yishuv, by 1918, Ben Gurion, who would eventually become the first prime minister of the Zionist entity, has settled in Palestine. So it's around this time when he helps with the formation of Pal Zion, which is the Zionist Worker Party. It's a Marxist party with explicit Zionist interests. So in 1919, this party merges with other smaller groups, and they form the Socialist Workers' Party that ideologically supported the, quote, Zionist proletariat. There's also another Zionist party at this time called Hapoel Hetzer, which focuses more on settlers living in the kibbutzim. And so in 1920, Pal Zion and Hapoel Hetzer create a single union together called the Histadrut. So the Histadrut and the Yishuv are kind of the two big things that we've encountered along with the Haganah. And we're going to be talking about the relationship between these three things leading up to the revolt and, of course, the Nakba. And so Pal Zion, Hapoel Hetzer merge, they create the Histadrut, and Ben Gurion is leading a lot of the activities that are going on throughout this. It establishes itself in 1920 as a Jewish-only labor union under the slogan Exclusively Jewish Labor. It has 4,000 members upon its founding, and it worked in tandem with Jewish capitalists to inflict violence against Arab workers and colonize Palestine. So if you go to that next slide, you'll actually see two things side by side. One, you have the kind of member card for the Arab Workers Union that forms, and we'll talk about that later. And then on the right, you have this kind of propaganda poster for the Histadrut. And so labor Zionism really solidifies itself as the driver of settler colonialism in Palestine, and it emboldens the Zionist working class to align with Zionism over class solidarity with Palestinian workers. And so while the Histadrut there was kind of like a dense network of institutions and public services, there were also subordinate networks that worked in collaboration with resettlement agencies, for example, to resettle workers in other parts of the world in what would hopefully be for Zionists Israel. And so they also have oversight, the Histadrut has oversight over the Haganah. So the Histadrut has oversight over the militia that ends up being responsible for the Nakba. And again, it's one of these militias that is ethnically cleansing Palestine, and it's doing so with the approval of the Yishuv and, of course, the British mandate. So at this time, unfortunately, Jewish work and production comes to necessarily and quickly denote both the violent expulsion of Arab workers from Jewish unions and the boycott of all Arab products. We also see a dual wage structure emerge during the mandate period that facilitates unequal wages for Palestinian workers. And then in the summer of 1921, Arab railroad workers attempt to join the Histadrut as their kind of first attempt at unionizing. Gone are the days of agricultural work. These Arab railroad workers want to be a part of the Histadrut. Show of hands, how many of you think Arab workers were admitted into the Histadrut? Surprise, they were rejected. And that is because the Histadrut was first and foremost a staunchly political party representing Zionist interests over working class interests. And so by 1922, Ben Gurion declared, quote, "The only concern which dominates our thinking and activity is the conquest of the land and building it through mass immigration. All the rest is only phraseology." And so the labor Zionist movement didn't raise principled arguments against private property. It didn't really try to challenge the capitalist system. It often worked in tandem with it. Its demand from the emerging bourgeoisie was for private capital to fulfill its role, to develop the land and absorb settlers into the Zionist national project. So Ben-Gurion and his labor Zionist ilk frequently and explicitly argue for the elevation of ethnic and national interests over class solidarity. And so by 1923, this Socialist Workers' Party that Ben-Gurion helped form splits along the political line of Zionism, and the anti-Zionist faction of it goes on to form the Palestinian Communist Party, and that party is admitted into the Third International. By 1925, Palestinians established Jamaat al-Ummal al-Arabiya al-Filistiniya, the Palestinian Arab Workers' Society, and that's that thing that you're looking at on the left of that slide. And so quickly, the Palestinian labor movement is kind of gaining foot as they industrialize and realize that there is no point in trying to form the solidarity along class bases. They form it at this intersection of both their class position and their nationalist position. And so it's primarily Palestinian working class people that are a part of this and forming this sort of labor movement. So on the next slide, you'll see the Women's Union, which we'll talk about in a second. But railway workers also begin registering for their own charitable associations. And lots of unions are beginning to engage in solidarity activities like caring for sick workers, caring for their families. And the Palestinian labor movement, in an industrial sense, is really getting its footing. The railroad sector specifically is a site where a lot of tensions between native workers and settler workers intensify. And these are some of the foremost sites of the 36 to 39 revolution. So just pay attention to that when we get there. And then also in 1929, the Arab Women's Association / Union, AWA, AWU, is the most active women's group in Palestine, which is that picture on the slide that you're looking at. And so they create the first Arab Women's Congress, and they begin creating local chapters and national committees. And so you have organizing along labor, you have organizing along gender, and then you also have this general organization as a part of kind of a national liberation struggle that's beginning to fester. And then on the next slide, we're going to talk a little bit about El Barak, because it ends in a general strike and it contributes to these stoking tensions that result in the revolution. So in 1928, Zionist settlers, emboldened by the connected institutions of the governing Yishuv, the Union Histadrut, and the militia of the Haganah, begin imposition on Hayt El Barak in Jerusalem, also known as the Western Wall, which is also a significant site of Palestinian and Muslim history. And as early as 1922, settlers began occupying this area through deliberate attempts by Zionist and British forces to desecrate the holy site, deny Muslim worshippers access to it, and claim that site and Jerusalem as a whole as a Jewish-only site. And so by August of 1929, Zionists organize a large demonstration at this site. They bring Zionist flags, they're chanting the Zionist national anthem, they're talking about, they use the slogan, "This wall is ours," and they claim it as an exclusively Jewish site along with the rest of Jerusalem. And of course, the British military is facilitating this demonstration and dispatching forces to escort and protect the settlers. And so the following day, Palestinians in Jerusalem lead a revolt against this, and it breaks out into kind of this entire clash. News spreads quickly all over Palestine, and there are several days of uprisings against the occupation of the wall and what it represents, which is the entire occupation of Jerusalem. And so the British then lead a wave of counterinsurgency and retaliation against Palestinians. They raise charges against 1,000 members of the uprising, and then 27 Palestinians were sentenced to death. So while the majority of the death sentences end up being commuted, there were three people, Fuad Hassan Hajazi, Muhammad Khalil Jamjoun, and Ata Ahmed Azir, and those are the pictures that you're looking at on that slide. They were sentenced to death. And there's a really great reading by Rana Barakat. It's called "Criminals or Martyrs, Let the Courts Decide: The British Colonial Legacy in Palestine and the Criminalization of Resistance." If you just look up Rana Barakat, "Criminals or Martyrs," I'm sure you'll find it. But it talks a lot about this specific trial and how racist the British colonial courts were and how hard Arab lawyers tried to no avail to kind of work within that system. And so following their execution, a general strike breaks out in Palestine in 1930. And so now we're on this slide about dispossession and class formation, and the slide that follows it with some of these statistics. So by 1930, the situation in Palestine is untenable. Jewish settlements have grown exponentially, and so has the exploitation and dispossession of Palestinians. And this has happened for several reasons. But one example is that a sizable portion of the settlers arriving in Palestine in the 1930s were capitalists, or people who owned the means of production and therefore got their wealth through worker exploitation. So they pushed both settler capitalists and settler The push by both settler capitalists and the working class leads to a lot of violent encounters, and it pushes a lot of Palestinians into unemployment. Cities like Yafo, which are these major port cities and are sites for both like dock workers and harbor workers, as well as railroad workers, face unbelievable unemployment rates. And so on these next slides, we can see some of the propaganda of the Histadrut that's emerging at this time. They're a key example of how this violence kind of operates and unfolds, especially given the relationship to the governing Yishuv and the Haganah militia. And so by 1936, membership in the Histadrut is at 41,000 Jewish-only workers. And as the Histadrut is strengthened and settler capitalists gain power, more violent attacks continue to break out. And so you can understand these conditions that are leading up to the 36 to 39 revolution. There's like a series of very concrete events, explicit statements made that lead up to this. It didn't come out of nowhere. Also by 1935, the settler capitalist forces controlled 872 of the 1,200 industrial firms in Palestine, employing nearly 13,000 workers compared to 4,000 employed by Arab capital. Also between 1931 and 1937, we see a 10% decrease in the wage for Palestinian workers that coincides with a 10% increase in wages for Jewish workers. And then the census in 1937 showed that Jewish workers' wages were on average 147% more than their Arab counterparts. And when we zoom in on specific sectors and specific demographics, the difference is astounding. So in the textile industry, for example, if we're focusing just on women, Jewish women who worked in the textile industry had wages that were 433% higher than Palestinian women, which is unbelievable. And so on this next slide, we have a quote by Hassan Kanafani. I'm not going to read it all, but long story short, it begins to illustrate that there is this contradiction emerging between the Arab and Jewish proletariat at this time, and it's solidifying because of the question of Zionism. And of course, the British don't stop being an active player in this process of dispossession, so we're going to talk a lot about the British on the next slide. The British Mandate authorities actively helped to enable Jewish capitalists in their bid to take over the economic infrastructure of Palestine. Infamously, the Jewish Mandate government awarded 90% of all of its concessions to the exclusively Jewish labor sector. And this handover led to Palestinians being dispossessed, not just from their land, but from their future. It meant that Palestinians couldn't build roads, they couldn't build ports, they couldn't invest in infrastructure for electricity or water. They didn't even have access to resources that would come from someplace like the Dead Sea, for example, which they still do not to this day. And then, of course, the Palestinian elites were also a very key player at this time. So Palestinian elites within Palestine aim to consolidate their class position by negotiating with the British. And so they try to take this route of diplomacy that, of course, ultimately fails. And they do this in the hopes that the British will be kind of like a better capitalist partner in development than Zionists, who are like more explicitly and upfront just trying to take their land. And so at various points, these Palestinian elites are colluding and working directly with the colonial administration. But Palestinians who were part of the popular classes and who were most directly experiencing the effects of both military occupation and colonial expansion clearly see that both British imperialism and Zionist colonialism are working hand in hand. These are both forces to be opposed, which is, of course, where Palestinian capitalists and the Palestinian elite don't make that distinction. And so on this next slide, you'll see that by 1935, 20% of Palestinians who comprised a traditionally agrarian society had been rendered landless. This is 13 years before the Nakba even happens, and 20% of Palestinians who comprise agrarian society have been kicked off of their land. So dispossession from the land happens through a lot of mechanisms, and a lot of these mechanisms come from the British economic regime. They tax Palestinians at an extremely high rate, completely disproportionate to any of the amount of wealth that they're generating, and they redirect these taxes back into the British colonial and, by extension, Zionist colonial project. And so on this next slide, the outcome of these taxation policies were devastating. It results in Palestinian indebtedness, landlessness, and unemployment. Palestinian peasants are being driven off their land and into the cities. And when they do get to the cities, the job market is one that heavily favors and organizes in the benefit of incoming Zionist settlers. But it was also through this dispossession that a shared Palestinian identity among the working class solidifies. And as exploitation occurred through national exclusion and at the hands of imperialism and colonialism, this is how the struggle for Palestine becomes a national liberation struggle. And it also shapes the form of resistance that Palestinians choose to engage in. So it was not just a struggle about wages or workers' rights, it was about sovereignty over the land and resources. And so this violent process of colonization is kind of how we get to this synthesis of the Palestinian liberation struggle. And at its helm, of course, is the Palestinian working class. So we're going to get into the revolution now. But before we get into that, I first want to talk a little bit about Izzeddin al-Qasim, because it's really hard to talk about the revolution without at least acknowledging him as a figure that heavily influences how the revolt unfolds. So al-Qasim is often referenced as the person who sparked the great revolts of 1936 to 1939. But who was he? Why was he in Palestine? So al-Qasim was a Syrian Islamic scholar, imam, and reformist. And he took part in the struggle against the French occupation of Syria. And so following Sykes-Picot, when Arab lands were divided, and then Balfour, you know, obviously happens, al-Qasim refuses to accept Syrian defeat, and he wages a year-long counterinsurgency in the mountains of Syria. And then he is eventually sentenced to death by the French occupation, and so he escapes to the British Mandate of Palestine in 1921. There's a video on the next slide, we're not going to watch it, but if you want to learn more about him, it's in that video. But to sum up kind of what's in there, his approach and his philosophy is so appealing to the Palestinian working class and to the Palestinian peasants because it is in direct opposition to kind of this philosophy of Palestinian elites. So he believes that the struggle against Zionism and the struggle against British colonial rule are inseparable, which the Palestinian elites do not. He rejects this route of negotiation and diplomacy that Palestinian capitalists favor. And he believes in the necessity of armed struggle led by the Palestinian, led by Palestinian popular classes. And so by 1935, it's clear that an armed revolt was imminent, and some of al-Qasim's cells of fighters are preparing for revolt. And so it was during this time that he's hunted and killed by British colonial authorities along with 12 of his men. And so his martyrdom infuriates Palestinian peasants and working classes, and his funeral is likely the largest political gathering to ever assemble in British Mandate Palestine. Some saying over 30,000 people attended his funeral, and the majority of them were peasants and the working class. And so even though al-Qasim is dead by 1935, his legacy plays a very instrumental role in the revolution and of the way that Palestinians conceptualize their own liberation. So now we have the final portion of these slides, which is the revolts. But let's take a breather. I feel like I've been talking for a long time. Can people just shout out who were some of the key players at the time, by the time we arrive in 1936, who are the key players in this? Palestinian peasants and workers, amazing. Who else? Yeah.
The British.
The British, of course. Who else?
Palestinian bourgeoisie.
Yes, the Palestinian elite, amazing.
JNF,
yes, of course. Anything else? Yeah. The revolutionaries, yeah. So we have the JNF, we have the Zionists who are working as the Yishuv, the Haganah, the Histadrut. Lots of other American labor forces are at play. Of course, the British imperialists. We have the Palestinian elite who play a key role in this, and actually the downfall of the revolution, which we'll get to. And then we have the Palestinian working class and peasants. Great job, everyone. So today the Zionist state reproduces this narrative that the revolt was sporadic, terroristic, unorganized, just a random group of people with no interests who have this inclination for violence, which I'm sure we've heard a lot. And through policies that suppress Palestinian history and denigrate revolt as a symbol of resistance, Zionists have actively attempted to like hide and bury history, not just about the Nakba, but about the revolt itself. And so Zionists still depict the revolt to this day in this kind of fashion, and it's nothing short of imperialist propaganda. It ignores the fact, of course, that for 3 years, the British were faced with the largest anti-colonial revolution of the interwar period, led by the Palestinian working class. And this revolt is best characterized in three phases. So phase one is kind of this marriage between a nationwide strike that's happening in the urban areas and armed revolt that's happening in the rural areas. The second phase is a predominantly mass armed revolt that comes very close to victory. And then the third is characterized by mass repression and slow defeat. So if we go onto this slide of phase one, we're just going to talk a little bit about what's happening in phase one. So the revolution begins in April of 1936 when Qasimites attack a convoy of trucks between Nablus and Tulkerem. And this represents the beginning of the revolution's first phase. This begins with a nationwide strike that lasts for 6 months in the city, an armed revolution in the countryside. And the strike itself creates a lot of grassroots infrastructure through popular committees and bodies that will solidify in the second phase. So we have committees and bodies that are advocating for strike suppression, medical assistance, legal services, financial support, conflict resolution, different affinity organizing for women and student groups, and committees that oversaw the boycott of both Zionist and British goods. And as you can see on that next slide, oftentimes the strike is thought of as separate from armed struggle, but it was actually part of a united strategy between urbanites and peasants to combine their tactics. At least 6,000 to 8,000 Palestinians and Arabs took part in the armed revolt, and British took heavy efforts to suppress this. They admitted 3,000 Jewish settlers into the police as supernumeraries who were sanctioned to use rifles against the resistance. At Haifa, British authorities and the Zionist movement had a clear and common interest in breaking the August strike, and they succeeded in doing so through sheer military force supplied by the British and highly motivated strike breakers supplied by the Union, the Histadrut. And so the strike ends in late 1936, early 1937, and this brings us to this next slide and this next phase that launches just a few months later. And so the second phase is built on tactics and institutions from the previous bout. It's marked by clandestine hit squads, rural paramilitary cadres, and it achieves real success in terms of challenging the British. The British are frightened. And on the next slide, you can read what Hassan Kanafani has to say about this. But right now, I want to use this time to focus on the tactics and organizing that really come out of this second phase. So freedom fighters from all over the Arab world are coming to join the Palestinian revolt. And the revolt was both decentralized and organized in a model that has been historically compared to a lot of like Vietnamese guerrilla fighters. And so there's a lot of like apt comparisons there. And if you look on the next slide, we're gonna talk very briefly about another popular symbol that emerges. How many of you know or have a keffiyeh? Oh, very nice. So there's a lot of different and conflicting lore about how this keffiyeh emerges as our like national symbol. But this is some of that lore. So another popular symbol that emerges at this time is the keffiyeh. The keffiyeh is a scarf worn by peasants. It originated in Iraq, but it kind of came to symbolize the peasant class in Palestine. And as we know, many of the armed revolutionaries were peasants themselves. And so the story goes that during the revolts, an armed fighter was trying to escape and hide from the British, who were hunting him down. But Palestinians across all centers, urban and rural, began wearing the keffiyeh more popularly to foil the efforts of the British to find him. And so this turns the keffiyeh into a symbol of Palestinian resistance that it is today. But it also is the story about Palestine's popular cradle. And we see this tactic happening even now. If you look up Odeh Tamimi, who is a part of Shafat refugee camp, all of the refugee camp shave their head bald, just like him, when he kind of fled after an operation. So you can always read more about Palestine's popular cradle. Just look him up. But during the phase, large parts of Palestine's interior were fully under rebel control. So rebels established significant institutions like their own courts and their postal services to replace the British mandate structure. Revolutionary commanders established a ban on debt. They tell peasants not to pay their taxes to the British. They canceled the construction of roads and police posts. And they engage in a lot of different kinds of like armed tactics. And you can see one on that next slide of Palestinian disturbances. They kind of derail one of the trains that was being transported. And just to give a sense of some of these operations, so there are 109 attacks against the British military and police and military centers. There are 143 attacks against Zionist colonies. And there are 82 operations cutting telegraph and telephone lines. And on that next slide, we'll talk a little bit about this right now. The most vulnerable section of the grid, as well as the part of the grid that had the most railways, telephones, and telegraph lines, was between Tulkarem, Nablus, and Jenin. And so a stretch of the land that the British come to name the Triangle of Terror, because how much heat is kind of going on at this time there. And Palestinian revolutionary Bassel al-Arij goes on to name this the Triangle of Fire. And so the British, meanwhile, who felt the impact of the sabotage, cracked down even harder. So they ban all Palestinian political parties, they ban the Arab High Commission, they arrest community leaders, and they exile a number of high-profile figures in the revolution. And on the next slide, we can see kind of what I'm about to discuss, which is that military aspects of the counterinsurgency started to intensify. So British bring in their tanks, they bring in airplanes, they bring in heavy artillery, and they're deployed all throughout Palestine. Collective punishment is also dispensed on Palestinians by the British at this time. Thousands of Palestinians were put in detention camps. Residential quarters were completely destroyed. Schools were closed. Villages were collectively as a whole fined. And they were also forced to billet British troops and the police. And so Zionist military institutions take advantage of this situation to build up their capacities, specifically through armed force with the support of the British. And by 1939, members of the Jewish Settlement Police, who are about 14,000 people, subsidized by the British government, armed in uniform, kind of serve as this cover for the Haganah. And they go on these special night squad operations. these combined forces of Jewish and British members launching widespread attacks against Palestinian villages. And so on this next slide, you see a comparison of Palestinians wearing a tarbush versus a kufiya. And so this is when Palestinians begin to sort of build their own infrastructure completely separate of the state. So it was not only the British and Zionists who the revolt targeted, it was also the Palestinian elite, who were profiting off the dispossession of peasants and collaborating with imperialists. And so the revolutionaries forbid debt collectors from entering the village. They abolished rents in urban areas. They forced urban offenders to replace their high status tarbush with a kufiya. So if you're going to be Palestinian, you're going to be part of the Palestinian working class struggle. There is not going to be, there's basically a big crackdown on Palestinian elites, for long story short. Hundreds of members of the elite actually fled the country entirely to escape the legitimacy established by the popular classes, which we see all throughout history kind of everywhere. And then on this next slide, we have a depiction of someone talking about these courts. So the revolution didn't just aim to cut the cord of Zionism and imperialism. It also sought to build its own infrastructure that historians talk about as a counterstate. And so they set up an alternative state apparatus in the countryside and a network of committees formed that we kind of talked about earlier. The rebels also work hard to establish a legitimate revolutionary court. And the courts are trying everyone, people who collaborate with the British, rich Palestinians who are exploiting poor Palestinians, collaborators, spies, etc. And some charges in these courts include oppressing the poor. So you could be charged with oppressing the poor. You could be charged with refusing to give money to the revolution. You could be charged with passing on information to the British enemy. And it begins to be seen as a legitimate threat to both Zionists and the British. By 1938, commanders of the revolution forbade Palestinians from using British mandate courts. All affairs had to be settled through the revolutionary courts. They also had written codes of laws and regulations and established a central court of the revolution. And so the courts acted to legitimate the spread of rebel authority, and they quickly began to fill the void that was left by the withdrawal of the mandatory British government. And so by this time, a lot of the British mandatory government had waned, and in its place rise these infrastructures that Palestinian working classes built. And so because of this, the remaining British forces target the revolutionary courts. They raid them, they arrest judges, they seize typewriters, documents, telephones, etc. And at this point, the revolt had become the government. And so it was an incredible threat to British colonial society, imperialist society, and of course to Zionism. And so on this next slide, you see Bashir Ibrahim. He was one of the judges in these courts and a commander of the guerrilla forces in Tulkarem, Nablus, and Jenin. So on this next slide, we're going to talk about phase three, the final phase. We're almost done. We cannot understand the revolts without looking at the kind of repression that the British heavily mobilize against it. It also allows us to understand the great power of the revolution and the extent to which the imperialist project sought to crush it and make the Nakba possible. And so on this next slide, it talks about all the tactics that the British employed. These are tactics that are still employed to this day. It was also during this time that, and you can talk about this on the next slide, you'll see that the British created this law in 1936 that is still used today. It is every single Palestinian knows what this law is. It is a way to imprison Palestinians en masse without trial or charge. So the way that this works is the law that they create allows them to imprison someone for 6 months, no charge, and then they can extend it indefinitely. And this is how Palestinian prisoners stay in prison for years with no charge against them, having never gone to a court. And so this is like one of the main ways that Zionism today operates, and it originated from the 36 to 39 revolts. And so the image on that slide is of Palestinian men and boys who were imprisoned under these emergency regulations that would become part of the laws governing Israel today. And so throughout the revolt, they built even more prisons, even more cages, even more detention camps. And on this next slide, you'll see that by 1939, it was estimated that at least 10% of Palestine's male population was either dead, imprisoned, or in exile. And so this is something that happens over the course of 3 years. Imperialist oppression against the revolt relied heavily on Zionist settlers who armed and enabled all of this to happen through this Yishuv, Histadrut, Haganah front. And so the British are arming and training thousands of Zionist police and settlers across Palestine who would eventually come to replace them when the Nakba happens. So they would conduct raids against villages, they would arrest those who harbored sympathy for Arabs, And Zionists went on to commit the atrocities of the Nakba with the help of this British counterinsurgency. And they also relied on counter-revolutionary Palestinian elites to suppress the movement within. So the most heinous example of this were these so-called peace bands, which were outfitted and directed by British and Zionist intelligence, and they waged political and military battle against the revolutionaries. And so these peace bands, comprised of Palestinian elites, play a decisive role towards the end of the revolt. And so by the end of the revolt, this three-year period, 5,000 Palestinians had been killed and 15,000 had been wounded. And there's this quote on the next slide. I'm going to read it. It's by Ghassan Kenafani. He says, in the whole history of the Palestinian struggle, the armed popular revolt was never closer to victory than in the months between the end of 1937 and the beginning of 1939. In this period, the British forces' control of Palestine weakened. The prestige of colonialism was at its lowest, and the reputation and influence of the revolt became the principal force in the country. And so just as there is this continuity of British to Zionist repression tactics, there is this continuity of Palestinian resistance to those tactics that occurs to this day. And the fight to preserve and revive this kind of history that we're talking about and to resist its erasure is happening because it's not just history, it's part of this ongoing struggle that we've seen happen for national liberation against both Zionism and imperialism, and of course in opposition to collaborationists like the Palestinian elite. And so with this presentation and this hopefully facilitated discussion that we're going to get into, we really hope not only to kind of like deepen your understanding of the conditions of the Palestinian struggle, who are its enemies, who are its allies, what drives its revolution forward, but also getting us to think about like how this relates to what we're talking about today. I'm sure I said like a million things where you're like, oh, I've seen something on the news about this. Oh, I've seen something that reminds me of something that I just saw the other day. And that's because it is a very ongoing history and a very repetitive one. So as we move forward, I hope you just kind of keep those things in mind and it informs the discussion that we're about to have. And on the next two slides, you'll just find some readings that are helpful and that a lot of this presentation was based off of. And with that, I will pass it off to Iman.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.